You're listening to Drake in the Morning
with Danny, Wes, and Sid
on 98.1 The Max.
David Waters is our friend and our guest on Tuesdays. He writes for the Commercial Appeal. He's one of the few reasons to keep paying a buck and a half or subscribing to it online, because he writes stories in here, usually three a week. And we were discussing off the air the kind of it's online sometime and then it's in the paper later.
It's always online.
Yeah.
It's always in the paper. It's just not on the same day.
Yeah. And the theory behind that is?
Well, we post just about everything that comes out of our staff. We post it as soon as we can. Thinking is that you want to get it out there as soon as you can. Why wait? You've got it. It's done. Put it out there in the media, social media world. Let people start reading it. And then it will run in print the next day or maybe 2 days later, maybe on Sunday.
But why deny the great writing to the people that still buy the paper if it's a hot piece and I want to see it?
Well, I think
so. I get denied for paying a buck and a half a day like a chump.
I hear you. And we've had a lot of problems with that, a lot of pushback. Why put something online? Doesn't it undermine people who buy the paper? Well, in some ways, I guess it does, but also you have to realize that it's probably two different audiences. Generally speaking, people who read online don't buy the print product, and people who buy the print product, like my mom, like me, don't really spend a lot of time reading it online. So
this is
hopefully you're getting the same two different audiences in the same same way,
which is fine, and it's and it makes everybody they get to see it sometime. This is uncharted territory. And that, I think, is the underlying issue.
Every day is a
new day. No one knows
exactly
what to do.
Nobody's figured it out. And it's not just newspapers. The music industry is still trying to figure out what to do with Spotify and Pandora.
They're clueless.
Nobody's buying CDs anymore.
No.
The book world, I mean, you're buying books on Kindle. You're buying books online. You're streaming books. You're
Network TV
on Google,
is a complete mess.
TV, the whole, all entertainment, all content is trying to find new ways to get to you. And you've got more control than you've ever had before. You can decide what you want to get, when you want to get it, where you want to get it. You want to sit on the beach and read a book or a newspaper, you can do it. You want to watch a movie while you're driving down the road, you can do it. So I think all of these content
producers, which is always a good idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Yeah. All these content producers are trying to figure out how can we keep getting the content to people who want it in different ways.
But there are just so many hours in a day, and if you let it overwhelm you, it certainly can.
Yeah,
there are too many choices.
Well, I agree with that. I think we're inundated not just with
there's
news,
too much
we're inundated with everything. It's like that Don Henley song, "Everything All the Time." Well, you can't have everything all the time.
There,
it makes you crazy.
I've been saying this for a few years because you can just feel it coming at you like a funnel cloud. There's too much of everything. That's what helped to blow up ESPN in its recent incarnation. There was too much.
You're talking about ESPN, the endlessly self-promoting network.
Yes. They had one TV station. Then they had ESPN2. Then they had ESPN News. Then they had ESPNU. Then they had the SEC network, which I think is about six different channels. Regionally, they had the Texas Longhorns network and the endless stream of things like that. Plus the online services, the inside subscription thing.
ESPN Radio.
Plus ESPN Radio, which has some good moments, but not that many. But the inundation of that, the overwhelmingly impossibility of filling 24/7 on all those platforms blew them up. And now there are some really qualified and really good journalists that have no jobs. They have blown that thing to pieces because when you're losing money for Disney/ABC and Bob Iger sees that it is because of ESPN, well, they start cutting heads off.
Mm.
And so that was the first sign. These things get so big they eat themselves. There's too much sports coverage. There's too more. You knew that ESPN was in trouble, first of all, a decade ago when they showed people playing poker on TV. You knew that was going to be trouble. And then the coup de grace, the end of it, I knew it was over. And I was up one morning, about 4 o'clock, and they are showing a video game tournament from Las Vegas. And people are crying and winning money and hollering and falling out because there's two dudes sitting there playing Madden football. And I thought, man, this is over.
That's it.
But this is how it, you get so much, and you cannot control it. And then the average person, like me in a day, I try to ingest as much as I can from reading, from television. I watch movies, and I try to just cram all this in. But in the course of a day, I cannot watch more than like one movie, maybe two episodes of Gunsmoke, one something, and then one thing at night. And then I got to watch, you know, America's Got Talent and cry over that. And then dancing competition shows. It keeps me up constantly. But seriously,
who has time to sleep?
There's just too much.
There is too much. And, you know, I think it's a blessing and a curse, right? I mean, you can find out information you could not have found out 15, 20, 30 years ago. You can find out what's happening in other parts of the world.
Which may not be good.
You can sit in your bathroom and read the New York Times without ever going to buy one. I mean, you can find out more information than ever.
Yeah.
But the problem is you can find out more information than ever. So there's this inundation of so-called information, news, facts, and there's really no... There are very few gatekeepers anymore. So you really don't know who to trust anymore, number one.
And the next level of that, if that is the top tier, that you have access to all this information from endless sources, the next thing is, I mean, you ingest all these things from the source of your choice. Then you take the information that you have gleaned from those things and go onto social media and start ruining people's lives because you're now an expert because you've just read the things that you believe to be true. You espouse them on Facebook, and then the hating starts.
And then if some crazy guy from Illinois goes to Washington and shoots up a congressional softball game. That's exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
We're not only getting too much information that doesn't make sense, that nobody's sort of helping us filter and make sense of. We're getting the information from our own little silos. So we're getting information that fits our particular worldview.
And your interpretation of it then ends up on Facebook and Twitter, and you begin a stream of hate that, you know, roils over into this, that, and the other. And this morning, I almost laughed out loud at the stupidity. And these are probably good gentlemen. The two Germantown aldermen who are having a pissing contest on Facebook and putting out people's home addresses, and they're all offended and they feel threatened. What?
Yeah.
I mean, there's just no end to it.
Yeah.
But
I don't know what's going to happen with social media.
I wish it would be outlawed. I wish that it would be just, you know, commandeered by the Russians and let them have it. I mean,
they may take it.
They may already have it.
Yeah, right.
But there are these levels that we get all the info.
And we're not sure where it's going.
And we're not
from.
Sure if it's true or not. Right. And then we spit it out. And probably in translation, we lose part of the real foundation of it and the fact and or truth. And then it becomes that game where you just pass it on, and it changes to every person.
Right. It's like that old game of telephone we used to play in the classroom.
Exactly. Whisper it into their ear.
By the time he gets around it, it's not even close to what it
It's totally different.
Out as. Yeah.
But that to me, I think is a problem waiting to explode. There's too much, and it's going to cause problems. It already has in job loss in your business, in radio business, in the TV business, and it's not going to get any better.
Yeah, well, that's
Amazon will own the world.
That's another really important issue. I mean, we're not only getting too much information. And we don't know where it's coming from. We can't know if we can trust it or not.
Right.
But there are actually so many fewer journalists out there actually working to get information because we've had so many layoffs and so many problems in the newspaper world and the TV world with just employing journalists. You know, we used to have over 200 journalists in Memphis at the Commercial Appeal alone.
And 200?
And now we have fewer than 50.
Wow.
And Memphis hasn't shrunk.
Yeah.
It continues to grow. So we have a quarter of the people we used to have covering even more territory, even more information and news, and we just can't keep up like we used to.
Since you're here, and you are our only contact, really, to that paper, and it's just part of your life and always has been, Let me ask you this, because this is the one that I don't understand. The supplements that show up in the paper on Tuesday, the one that I buy here is the one from Germantown. Mm-hmm. The one at home is from South Haven. Without fail, those supplements are filled with week-old news.
Yes.
Why?
That's an excellent question.
Is it more pages to sell ads on?
Yes. And here's the reasoning
but
behind
it's,
that.
It is a slap in the face to journalists and journalism and newspapering all over the world and from the history of the first paper. It's awful.
Well, the thinking, and this has gone back several years, the thinking is that because of the way the newspaper industry has changed over the years financially, because of the way everything is changing, advertising, we have to find ways to make ourselves competitive locally. So if you have a mom-and-pop shop out in East Memphis or in DeSoto County or in Collierville, you probably can't afford the rates that we charge for the full run of the newspaper that we charge grocery stores or car dealers or phone companies. You know, they can pay for that stuff.
Right.
But if you have your own restaurant or you have your own little shop down in DeSoto County, you probably can't pay. And you're really not trying to reach the entire Memphis SMSA anyway.
Right.
But you want to reach the people in DeSoto County, or maybe you just want to reach the people in South Haven. So how can we help you do that financially? Well, we can offer this DeSoto County only section or this Collierville only section once a week to help you advertise. Now, the content, you know, the problem with the content is that we could put new content in it. We could put just DeSoto County content into it. And that's what we used to do. We used to have a DeSoto County Bureau.
Right.
They used to have six or seven full-time journalists just covering DeSoto County.
Right.
Well, those days are gone. We just don't have the manpower we used to
have. But it seems counterproductive to the theory that, the sports scores, the news are on your phone, available the moment they happen.
Yeah.
So that's one side of it. The other end of it is that you're assuming that people in South Haven or Germantown are okay with seeing week-old news, which is a completely counter idea to the immediacy of getting it on your phone. So you got one end here and, right. and one end here.
Right.
So you just can't have it both ways based upon ad sales, because we have the paper at home, and the first thing that we toss is the South Haven insert, because
you've already read it.
We saw this last week.
Yeah.
Once again, this is not a forum to beat up.
Well,
I
appreciate that. And I think there might be a better way to go about it. I mean, if it really is an advertising vehicle, and it really is a way not only for us to get more revenue locally, but for local advertisers to have better ways to reach customers, then why not just make it what it really is, an advertising supplement? And maybe you could put one or two, pictures or a column or something out there, find a local DeSoto columnist, find a Collierville columnist to put out there, make something new and fresh, but make it what it is. It's for local advertising. It's for DeSoto County advertising, whatever. This is what it is. That may entice you to spend more time looking at it. You're looking to see who in South Haven or Hernando is going to advertise this week.
The paper in town is our discussion this morning with our friend David Waters, the commercial appeal. This morning, the ads that I pulled out were as big as the paper itself, and I tossed them first, which they probably have been retrieved gone through. But compared to writers, how many salespeople are left?
Well, I don't know the exact numbers because we've just gone through some transition. They redid the whole staff, the whole advertising sales staff. So I'm not exactly sure how many.
Well, their job can't be really.
And they're reorganized too. No, it's a tough job. Listen, It is a difficult sell, not just because it's the newspaper, just because the advertising has changed so much. And because of digital advertising and marketing and social media, if you're a restaurant out in DeSoto County, what's the best way for you to reach your customers? Well, it used to be put an ad in the newspaper, and I still think that's a good idea, but there are so many other options you have.
Yellow Pages for a
yellow. Who uses the Yellow Pages anymore, right?
Nobody.
Nobody, right. So you can get on social. You can have your own Facebook page. You can have your own Twitter account. You can do all these things on your own that don't really cost any money, and actually are pretty effective at reaching people. And that's actually the biggest challenge that not just newspapers are facing, but all kinds of print publications.
Yeah.
How do we keep? And ESPN is facing that problem too.
Yeah.
Social media has hurt ESPN too.
Yes. And just the sports, you know, on my phone, I can hit one little app and see if the Cubs played, if they're playing right now, and if they won.
Right.
I can check betting line. I can check anything. I can, you know, it's right there on the phone, on the radio from Chicago or on TV.
Listen, before, you know, 20 years ago, how could you watch a Major League Baseball game? Well, you had to tune into one of the networks.
Once a week.
And then ESPN came along and said, we're going to show you a Sunday night game, a Monday night game, whatever. So you had more options during the week.
Actually,
baseball.
TBS and GN.
TBS and WGN, they, right. Braves and Cubs.
They changed it first.
So if you're a Minnesota Twins fan, you're out of luck. Yeah. Unless you live there.
Yeah.
So now, if you get the MLB app and you pay, I don't know, $6 a month or something.
$20 a year. A year, yeah.
Right, you can watch any game, anytime, anywhere you are. So what does that do to ESPN? What does that do to the networks? What does that do to WGN?
It hurts them,
not just because they can't. It hurts them financially because they can't sell ads like they used to. And that's the fruit baskets. It's turned over every day in the media world.
Yeah,
and everybody's scrambling to try to figure it out.
It's gotten so big, and people are trying to find answers in the corporate world. And the possibility that there are none is very real. There are no answers from day to day. They change.
They change every day. You're
and,
exactly right.
You know, ad sales, here and on television. I wouldn't be those people. That's a tough gig because network TV has become almost irrelevant. It is nothing but sports about competition, not sports, but shows about talent and singing and dancing and magic tricks and dancing shows and the occasional decent drama and a bunch of bad sitcoms.
Right. Well, does anybody watch commercials on TV anymore if you don't have to? You either get it from you either get live streaming, you get Netflix, which has no commercials, or you fast forward through it.
Yeah. Well, it is it's a conundrum that we can't you just sit back and watch it. The unfortunate part is it's what has been our life's work. And to watch it go the way it's going is a little bit depressing. But, you know, we still do it at home. We get it because you're in it. Today they got Jennifer Biggs in it. There is a section on a whiskey tour. And, you know, and there are some reasons to still get it. But when I get it in the morning and on the weekend especially, I don't have the same excitement when I go get it and my coffee to sit down and look at it. Because there's not going to be a lot there.
I hear you.
And
there's
that's
not
disappointing.
As much as it used to be. But and there is still more than any other news outlet.
It's the only one.
Yeah, we still have the biggest newsroom in town. We still have the most reporters out there covering the community.
And you also have the biggest building, which is about to, right. which is about to be it's. There's a for sale sign in front of the building.
If you know anybody who's looking for 300,000 really good square feet plus a couple of really cool printing presses,
our first thought was Sears, but
Sears and Penny's could set up shop
or a Kmart. But
they could print their own advertising circulars right there.
There you go. That must be a melancholy thing for those of you who've been there for a long time.
Well, I have. I just realized. I guess I've realized this before. I have spent more time inside that building than any other place on earth. I started working there in 1980, and I've gone there just about every day since. And it used to be full of people. There are five floors. We used to have one newspaper.
A vibrant, moving
newspaper. We used to have one newspaper on the third floor and a whole different newspaper on the fifth floor. The Press Cimeter was published in the afternoons. We used to have over 1,300 people working at that company, and now it's about 200 people. There's an entire floor that is not being used anymore. And it's just too big. It's gotten too big.
Yeah.
It's outmoded. It's outdated. We don't need that much space. We obviously don't need that much space for printing presses anymore because we're printing the paper in Jackson, Tennessee.
Right.
So we just have to find a space that works now for our new world, our digital age, and find new office space. And it's actually, you know, I mean, it could be an exciting thing. I don't know where they're going to go. But yeah, it's very sad because we all spent a lot of time there. We've had a lot of great moments there.
There's nothing like the environment in a place like that when it is buzzing and there are deadlines to be met.
It's the most exciting place on earth.
It's incredible.
It really is.
And you can kind of get that vibe from watching things like, there are various movies. All the President's Men has that excitement about it. And that's, you know, that not the impending doom, but the impending deadline. And just how you know, vital these things have always been to our lives, and how in 5 years they will likely not even be here, which is quite unfortunate.
One of the first jobs I had there was what they call the wire editor, and that was the person in charge of national and international news. And you would sit at your computer, and you would just sort of like the whole world was at your fingertips. Whatever happened in the world came over the wire through your computer, and you knew exactly what was happening. You knew the moment it happened, and it was like I was the first person in the city who knew what was happening in Washington or in London or wherever. And then your job was to sort of collate that, collect that, and put that in the paper the next day. And it was an incredibly exciting job because, like, when the shuttle exploded, awful, awful tragedy, but you're the first to find out.
Yeah.
And then you've got the responsibility to get the news out there. Those, now that we have the internet, now that we have, you know, Twitter and, you know, cell phones, well, that has changed too.
The first thing that I did as a pest at a station in a small town was to rip the AP wire.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where your news came from.
And you physically ripped it.
You
tore the paper off.
You had to put on these rolls of paper.
Right.
The consistency of a paper towel. And then we had one machine. It might have been AP and UPI, both. But AP was where you would go off and, you know, you would tear off the news briefs, a top of the hour, sports briefs, and then the body of the stories would come out. Then there were the pieces, stories that were a bit longer. And then when you heard the ding, 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 ding,
right,
you knew something was bad.
Right.
And I was there the night that Jimi Hendrix died, and I pulled that off the wire. That was 1970. Wow. I was 2 years old. And and so you heard that, you know, dinging, and you knew something was wrong. Otherwise, you're tearing off pieces, and there was a long board with nails on it. And one said national news, local news, sports and weather, and farm news.
Mm-hmm.
And so you tack them up there, and your news guys would then get those and go read them. But that's a long time ago.
So, you were probably using the white pages to call people.
Probably, not with my cell phone.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to watch the media transition into what I don't know what's going to happen next, but there is already too much. That's a problem. This whole binge watching thing, I think, is an offshoot of that problem. Trying to cram in, you know, 40 shows in a weekend. What the hell for?
Yeah, right.
It's just bad for your brain. But anyway. Recently you've been writing about various things. Let's cover Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day.
Yes, Lord. Thank you. And to you. We had a good time with the children and enjoyed that as always. And talked to my dad, who is 87. Sounds great. Hanging tough. So it's just funny how these things come and go. But we had the new gentleman from the Orpheum up here Friday. Mr. Batterson, and they have a program over at the Orpheum now for kids who lost their fathers at a young age. He lost his dad when he was 7, and so they have a new program this summer. That was the gist of it, Wesley, that they...
Right, and it goes through the summer. They have a vetting process, but essentially if you've lost a parent, then they will work to get you into this theater program.
Yeah, and which is just a really smart idea, and he... I did it up in Chicago and is doing it here. And that was a very nice touch, I thought, from them. But your piece was also pretty thoughtful.
Well, thanks. It was about the 1,000 Fathers March on Saturday here in Memphis.
And nobody showed up?
Well, there was about 100 fathers. I don't think they expected 1,000. But the 100 who showed up, most of them had grown up without fathers in their lives. And the guys I talked to, a couple of the men in the march, had amazing stories because, they grew up without fathers in their lives, but now they are fathers of their own, and they are trying to take that responsibility seriously, in large part because of what they didn't experience when they were growing up. And I think that was the point I tried to make in my column, is that there is a lot we can learn from men who grew up without fathers. We sort of have this almost pity about those young men who grew up without fathers, and it's not a good thing. But usually there's somebody in their life, some adult, and I think this is what makes the big difference. If you don't have a father in your life, whether that father is not physically present or just not emotionally present or is a bad dude, how can you make it without that father, especially if you're a young boy or a young man? And all these guys are saying it just takes one. It might be a coach. It might be your uncle. It might be a guy down the street, your friend's father. It just takes one adult in your life to make all the difference in the world. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you grow up. If you have that one adult, and I think that goes back to all the discussions we've had recently about mentoring. You know, we talk about mentoring programs and what good are they, but they really do make a huge difference. It just takes one guy to make all the difference in the world for one young man. And there's so many, you know, the numbers are just kind of staggering. In 1960, around the time I was born, maybe the time you were born, only fewer than 1 in 10 young people, young kids were growing up without a father in the home. Now it's over 50% in many cases. Mm. It's just staggering, the change.
Yeah, it is. I just can't imagine. There is no perfect father. It was not Ward Cleaver.
Right.
It wasn't Ozzie Nelson. It wasn't any of those people. That didn't exist.
Or Bill Cosby,
although he proved to be pretty close to perfect. He was proven not guilty. That's a whole different discussion. But, yeah, to not have one at all. There are famous people who have had great success that were raised by women.
Yeah.
And so, sure.
You can overcome it. People do. It happens every day.
Nicholson, Jack had. Sure. He was raised by his mom and his sister. He thought his mom was his or something.
But the odds are so stacked against you if you're a boy without a father.
Yes.
Yeah, and especially if you're a boy living in poverty or in difficult circumstances. Yep. Without a father.
No guidance, no one to smack your hand and tell you that you're wrong. Right. Or to teach you that what
and,
is
and
right.
And that's why we have gangs. I mean, that is the draw of gangs. Yep. The gangs become surrogate fathers.
It's a collective of boys.
They provide affection. They provide a sense of belonging. And there's someone you can trust. Finally, there's someone in your life you can trust. And that's why they continue to have gang problems, because they become surrogate fathers. And I think that's something that we have to begin to really address, is it's not just a criminal justice issue. When you're talking about gangs, we're talking about crime. It goes so much deeper than that. And it gets into families and it gets into households. And if we don't start addressing it from the very beginning, if we're just putting, you know, Band-Aids on the wounds.
I just don't know how we stop it, though. And it's not just here. It's not just the South. It's the problem persists because of reckless, immature behavior and lack of knowledge and education about what you're doing. And then you end up with these children that are babies, and then suddenly they're 18 and they're carrying AK-47s around for protection. And I don't see any end to it. It almost seems like it's unraveled to the point of not being fixable. In many cases, you just can't save the world, but at least you can discuss it and hope to find an answer, and maybe some ideas will be, you know, spawned from that.
Well, I do think it's important to keep trying, and there's a lot of people
out
there
keep trying, yeah,
every day who are trying to make this better and trying to do something. But like, yeah, these guys who did the march on Saturday, they're not just marching one day a year; they're out there every day, not just in their own homes, but in the neighborhoods, in the communities, trying to work with these fatherless boys and girls to try to make it better for them.
Well, those are special people who have their own place in heaven, whatever that may be. Our guest from the Commercial Appeal, David Waters, discussing, well, we covered all kind of stuff today. The sense of activism, things like this, and the things about marching have been pretty prevalent since the first part of the year for various reasons. Are they having any impact, do you think? Because there are so many, there are women's marches, there are dad's marches, there are marches against hate and racism and stuff. Do you sense that they're having any kind of impact in society among the culture that we have now, that is so diverse and divided? Of these things. Because people are marching, right, carrying signs, hollering, raising hell. It's either that or there is a vigil someplace for some kid that got killed. And I wonder if these things are having any kind of impact or if they're just being ignored.
Well, I don't know if they're changing anything immediately. I don't think they're having an immediate impact on policy or law or anything like that. But I do think they're a very healthy thing. I think it's a sign. All of those marches, all the advocacy that's going on is a sign of a very healthy democracy. And I think we hear a lot of negative things about the state of our democracy, especially lately. But I do think that all of the activism that you see, and it's not just people in the streets. I mean, there's so much activism on social media. There's so much activism, people getting together to organize for this or that. I do think that's a very healthy sign. And whether it has an immediate impact or not, I think over the long term, it will have an impact, number one. Number two, I think it's really healthy because I think it gives people some sense of personal responsibility and empowerment. I can speak up about this. I can do something about this. I don't like this. I can't just sit around and grumble about it. I can actually go do something about it. And maybe it's march in the street with a sign, or maybe it's form some kind of organization or some kind of group that will address this. I think it's having a long-term major impact, especially locally. I mean, there's so many local organizations. And I just, we've been talking about this juvenile court mess. There are several local organizations that have formed since the Department of Justice came in to try to fix what was wrong with our juvenile court system. We have become advocacy groups who are putting pressure not just on the national folks, but on local folks. And now that we're about to lose the DOJ oversight of our juvenile court system, I think those local groups are going to become even more important, because I think those are the people that are going to hold the sheriff and the mayor and the DA and the juvenile court judge accountable for what has to happen in our juvenile court system.
In as simple a way as you can, explain the basics of this, because the oversight is going away based upon what Jeff Sessions did.
So this began about 6-7 years ago when County Commissioner Henry Brooks asked the Justice Department to come in and look at our juvenile court system because she thought there were lots of problems with it. And it turns
state
out
state or federal?
Federal. People. Federal Department of Justice came in. Obama's Justice Department came in and did a long look at our juvenile justice court system and found major serious problems, some constitutional problems. Juveniles were not getting the due process they needed to get. They were not getting their constitutional rights. For example, you know, some of these kids would sit in jail 2, 3, 4, 5 days without ever having the very first probable cause hearing, because they didn't have hearings on weekends or holidays. They just didn't have representation. They didn't have a lawyer handy to get these kids. These kids would just sit in jail, charged with something, but you know they're not getting their due process. So that was one problem. The other problem was the detention center itself. There were all kinds of overuse of force, overuse of restraints, overuse of isolation. These kids were not being treated properly. That was number two problem. The biggest problem was that there was actual discrimination in the system. Now this is no surprise, but the DOJ showed that Black kids were being treated more harshly. They were much less likely to get diversion, much less likely to just get a warning and go home. They were much more likely to be sent to detention. They were much more likely to be kept there longer. They were much more likely to be transferred to adult court just because they were Black. So DOJ comes in and says, we're going to come in twice a year and monitor your court system. Here's what needs to change. Here's what needs to happen. We're going to make sure that these things are happening. And so ever since 2013, the DOJ has come in twice a year, sent monitors in to look at the due process stuff, to look at the what they call harm reduction, how kids are being treated in detention.
What had changed? Anything?
There actually has been a lot of changes over the past 5 years. They've done really well, especially with the harm reduction. The detention center is much safer now. There's much less use of force. There's much less use of restraints, much less use of isolation.
And they are enforced by who?
Well, that's a really interesting question. This is not something the DOJ can enforce. The Justice Department.
They come in, they see it, they leave.
They come in, they see it, they report it, and they leave. But so there's this sort of what they call a memorandum of agreement. The county agreed with the Justice Department to fix these things over time. And the Justice Department would come in at twice a year and say, here's what you're doing right, here's what's not happening yet, here's what needs to change. The Department of Justice has no authority to force the county to do this. They're just sort of like being an advisor, a consultant.
Right.
Here's what has to change. But somebody was watching out for it. And I think that's what was important about
it. So who pulled this off the board?
Well, we have a new president. You may have heard.
I heard.
And we have a new attorney general, Jeff Sessions.
Yes.
And they are much less interested than previous administrations in looking at issues like racial discrimination, systemic racial discrimination in mental health facilities or juvenile court facilities or whatever.
Is it being turned over? So is it a state's issue or just nobody cares?
Well, that's a really good question, too. Right now, the only hammer that anybody has had to make these local systems be less discriminatory or more fair or more constitutional has been the federal government, the Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division coming in and saying, this is not working, this is not right, you have to do something about this. Well, if that goes away, and it looks like that's going to go away, who's going to hold Shelby County accountable for these changes? The state might do some of that, but the state also has its own issues. The county has a lot of jurisdiction in these matters. The Shelby County government has a lot of authority. The juvenile justice court system has a lot of authority. So who's going to hold us accountable for making these changes? And well, the DOJ is going to leave.
Yeah.
And so who's going to monitor? Well, you know, I mean, to me, you shouldn't have to have the federal government come in and force you to do the right thing.
That was going to be my next comment, was it? We, you know, there's all this discussion and yelling about, I don't want the government in my business. Well, you don't want them in their, you know, in your business until you need them in your business.
Right.
And you can't have it both ways. So is it their place to oversee and to monitor every state in America that has problems like this? And likely they do in many cases. But, I mean, is it the government's problem to come here and tell us how screwed up we are?
Right. It shouldn't be. You shouldn't have to have the federal government come into your school system or your juvenile court system or any of your systems locally and say, here's what's wrong, here's how to fix it. We should be doing that on our own. We have not done that on our own, and thus you have the need for the federal government.
Right.
Now, will we? You know, we've got really good people in charge. We've got a mayor, we've got a sheriff, we've got a district attorney, we've got a juvenile court judge. These are good people who care. They know what has to change. They know what needs to be fixed. They're in the process of doing it. Will they continue to do it? Will they really tackle the issue? I mean, the major issue that still exists, that they've made no progress on this, and that is the discrimination part of this. There's still discrimination going on against African-American juveniles. It hasn't changed a bit in 5 years. And that's with oversight from the Obama Justice Department. So why would we think that oversight from the Trump Justice Department would change that? It won't.
Yeah.
So we've got to do something locally about that. And that's where I go back to the local advocacy groups. There's one called Mission MI, which stands for mass incarceration. Local groups sitting together to say, okay, how do we still have this discrimination problem? What is actually going on here? Why can't we fix this, even with federal government oversight? Let's look at it from different perspectives and see what else we can do to make this better. And I think as long as those people are pushing us locally, local people trying to make local officials accountable to make changes that need to be made, I think we're going to make some progress, I hope. But I honestly don't think that oversight from the Trump administration is going to change anything at this point.
Well, there are some issues here in this town, and we already have jails that are way overcrowded. There are many issues there. There are things that we all know that we really can't go into on the radio about how overcrowded and how these things are done. I have heard about them firsthand, seen them firsthand, and it's a mess, and it's not talked about. But Amy Weirich and Mark Luttrell Jim, and who, they can't do this by themselves.
Right.
And the system seems to be so bogged down and clogged up with kids and juveniles and these drug arrests and all this stuff. It is almost too much to handle or to tackle or to attempt to fix. And then if we do get back to, well, it just seems like maybe in general that the new government observation is to put it in the hands of the state, regardless of what it is. If we start locking up kids for having a joint again, we got a real problem there too.
Which we stopped doing.
Yes, which was, yeah. And I think here that common sense will rule the day when it comes down to individual officers that can make a decision right there. Do I just let this go, or do I drag this kid's ass down to 201 Poplar and clog up this system even more?
Right.
or do I let this go?
Well, I think,
and tell him, come on, son, get a grip.
Well, you're right. I think that is the number one concern among local people who are worried about the Justice Department leaving this situation.
And they seem to be very concerned.
Not only are things not going to get better, will they sort of revert back to the way they used
to
be?
Somebody has to stand up. But you get to a point where you just wonder, you know, we had this piece last week, and it's probably time again to have Miss Weirich on. I like Amy a lot. I don't know how in the hell she does this job. But there was a sense, and I felt kind of bad for her, and I felt her sense of desperation when they're writing these letters to people saying, and these are guys that keep, it's these guys that do the same stuff over and over again, from burglary to drugs.
Revolving door.
Will you please stop doing this? Will you please stop being a bad person? And I thought, it's come to that, to sending him cards saying, please, you're killing us. Can you stop being such? And then if they don't stop, then it gets a lot more severe. But just the concept and theory that you got to ask somebody via a postcard, cut it out, will you?
Well, obviously.
That's not a good sign.
It isn't. But it's obviously a lot more complicated than that.
It is.
And the juvenile justice system is one example of the problem. The problem has been this revolving door, people going through the system time after time after time.
And we've talked about this on this show for 10 years.
Right.
Wharton discussed this endlessly and didn't do dick about it.
Well, the problem is that, for example, in the juvenile justice system, studies have shown that once a kid gets wrapped up in the juvenile justice court system, he becomes then more likely to become involved in the adult criminal justice system.
Yeah.
It's just the way it is. So now they're trying to find alternatives to arresting a kid, putting him in detention, and making him go through the court system.
Right.
So how do we do that? How do we do that better? Not only for all kids, but especially for African-American kids, because those are the majority kids in our community. How can you get the help that they need before they enter the court system, which is going to be like a cycle that they'll never get out of?
How do you scare them straight now?
Scare them straight, or help them with whatever issue they're dealing with. You're talking about 10, 12, 14-year-old kids.
I know.
Who need support. And if you don't have a system that gets them the support they need when they're 10 and 12 and 14, then you're going to end up dealing with Amy's going to end up dealing with them. And that makes it not just more expensive, but ultimately more destructive for the entire community. You just have to go about it smarter. And I think that's one of the things that the DOJ people are saying. There are smarter, not only constitutional ways to do this, which we have to do, we should, but there are smarter ways to do this. And I think that's what people worry about. If DOJ leaves, are we going to continue to look for those smarter ways to address our juvenile crime problems?
Well.
And I think we are. I mean, I think we are capable of doing that. I think the people in charge want to do that. We just have to keep making progress.
Let's hope that we do, because these upbeat conversations are.
In fact, you're talking about ESPN.
Well, you know, but it's just the friggin' truth. And nobody talks about it, and everybody knows about it. They're too afraid to do it. They go home to the peace and comfort of their home, and they just, it's not my problem. Well, it's going to be your problem, but it is. You just start to get a sense of the overwhelming nature of what's going on, and it's frustrating. But I don't know what the answer is. Hopefully there are people that are much smarter than I am.
You're pushing that rock up the hill every day.
Every day, man. Thank you so much for coming to see us. Thanks, as always, we appreciate your time and enjoy the conversation. And commercialappeal.com, you can see David's work there a week before it's in the paper and he's on the show or somewhere. Your colleague has published today. I saw her piece about this. Yeah. And so good luck with the building sale. Are you going to be out yourself, like, trying to hawk this building to people? And
I'm actually right now trying to figure out what I'm going to take. A souvenir.
So have you had the same office for all those years?
Well, we don't have offices. We have a big newsroom.
Okay.
One of the great things about working for a newspaper has been to be in the newsroom.
cubicle.
Yeah. Well, they're kind of running around, but you know, not real big. It's not like The Office, you know, that movie Office Space. It's not like that. It's just the newsroom is like a living organism.
Yeah.
There's just constant movement, constant energy.
A vibrant,
not as much
pulsating,
as there used to be.
Yeah.
Because there's fewer people.
Well, there are challenges, and we don't mean to be critical, but I think it needs to be pointed out that people aren't dumb. We're paying attention to what's going on because we care about it.
Well, we appreciate that.
And,
we know.
And I mean, it'd be easy to just bitch about it, but we do it out of, caring.
We're still covering the news as much as we can.
Just keep selling those ads to Kroger and you'll be fine. And everything will be just
like cell phone companies. Thank God.
David Waters, thank you, sir. We'll be back.
Email us anytime at mail@drakeinthemorning.com.